All right, it is time for us to get started this evening. We're going to be in Numbers 33 and 34 tonight, and I will go ahead and say that the plan is to have one more class, which would be 35 and 36, but of course next week will be our singing, so that last class will be postponed for a week after that. So that's the plan moving forward. You say Sunday, Tom, is that what you said? You have more baptism to talk about, I think. You didn't get around to talking about baptism for the dead, so that still needs to be discussed. 33 and 34 tonight, 35 and 36 in 2 weeks, and then after that, David has graciously agreed to teach Thessalonians. I didn't have to twist his arm that hard. I just had to say, if you don't teach something, I'm going to teach again. And just like that, he was ready to go. So
you said you didn't have to.
That was the twisting of the arm. So he'll be teaching Thessalonians starting after that for at least a little while in the summer. I'll let him decide how long he'll take on that. So that's the foreseeable future, at least on Wednesdays. I don't know what's happening on Sundays, but I can only control what I can control. So. All right, let's begin with a prayer. Our good Father, we're thankful to you that you are a God who has made great promises to us, and that you are trustworthy in what you have said, and that there is nothing that can stop you from accomplishing what you have said you will do. And we know that sometimes we are our own worst enemies, that we are the ones that stand in the way of you accomplishing your will for us in our lives. And so, Father, we ask that we would humble ourselves before you, that we would listen to what you have to say, and that we would follow the path that you have made for us. We're thankful that you are a God of great forgiveness, far beyond our comprehension. We seek your forgiveness for when we are in the wrong, and we praise you and thank you for your forgiveness in every day of our life. Be with us in our study today. Help us to grow in our understanding of your word and grow to be more like you. And it's in your son's name that we pray. Amen. All right. So the book of Numbers is winding itself down at this point. And we've got a lot of things that on the one hand look kind of dull and boring and monotonous and repetitive and redundant and saying the same things over and over again. And it's, you know, here in this chapter, in chapter 33, it's this recounting of the journey. And we'll talk about that. And what I've found, at least in this chapter, is it's actually far more interesting and practical than I thought it was going to be at the outset. And then as we get into chapter 34, we have the boundaries of the land and the lists of the tribal chiefs, and we'll have a little bit less to say about that. But then we'll get into cities, and cities for Levites, and cities for refuge, and back to the daughters of Zelophehad. So it's potentially, you know, on the surface, it looks like we've got a lot of tedium ahead of us. But I do think there is value here, and even in the places where it may not be the most, you know, super exciting to work through, there's certainly value in what the text has to say. So, starting here in chapter 33, for almost this entire chapter, it is this recounting of the journey that they have taken, and it begins with Exodus. It doesn't begin with the book of Numbers, but it's the entirety of the journey. And basically, the chapter breaks down, or the section of the chapter breaks down into three parts. The first section deals with a bunch of the places where they stopped and camped. And in this section, not at every camp, but throughout it, it tells us about some stuff that happened at those stops along the way. Then you get into a very lengthy section in the middle where it's just spot after spot after spot. We stopped here, we stopped here, we camped there, then we moved on and we camped there. And it's just name after name after name. And then it comes back at the end and it returns to places where there is some information said about what's going on at those camps. There are evens at those camps. Probably some odds too. Maybe a few ends. Camps and events is obviously what that's supposed to say there at the end of that section. Now, before we talk about this from another perspective, one of the things that is worth noting about this list, a couple of things that are worth noting about this list from a big picture perspective. I guess I'll say at the outset, I'm not going to take the time to read through all of the names of these different places. If you're interested in reading all of those names, you're welcome to this evening later on your own time. But we'll note a few of them in particular as we go. But the first thing that I'd point out about this chapter and this recounting of the journey is that it is not an exhaustive list of everywhere that they stopped. It's kind of interesting because it excludes some of the places that are mentioned in Exodus and Numbers on their journey. And it also includes some that are not mentioned anywhere else in Exodus or Numbers. And so it's not designed to either be an exhaustive list of everywhere they stopped or even an exhaustive recounting of just what's mentioned in the biblical text. And so that, of course, raises the question of why are these places listed? And, you know, as we've said before, why is it talked about here in the book of Numbers? And as we've also said before, it's impossible to be certain about the specifics when the narrator doesn't give us any sort of answer whatsoever. But I think there's some basic ideas. Where there are events mentioned, it's pretty obvious those places are mentioned to talk about that thing that happened there. It's all of the ones that doesn't mention anything. Obviously, some of them have to be there just to have continuity in the story. But why specifically some where no event happened are mentioned and some aren't, I don't know that we can ever really know for sure. Obviously, the basic message is, I think, pretty clear. This is, you know, a summary of some of the main themes of Exodus and Numbers. It's a reminder of the great obstacles they have overcome, starting with leaving Egypt and crossing the Red Sea and working their way through the wilderness all the way to the point that they are now, including, of course, the extra 40 years that were not part of, Moses' original itinerary. And with that, there is this knowledge that God has been with them thus far. And so when you stop and you look back and you realize, you know, we've done good things and we've done bad things, and through it all, God has kept us and we are still here as this nation. And here we are yet again poised on the border of the Promised Land. And again, I think that's probably why it's showing up here, is because here they are about to go into the Promised Land. It's a reminder that God has made great promises and God has been with them thus far. And if He's been with them thus far, then surely they can count on Him to complete His purpose for them. What He has said He is going to do, how far He has brought them, He is going to continue and He's going to do what He has said that He is going to do. Beyond that general overview, it's really hard to say why these places are listed. We'll come back and look at this from a different perspective here in a few minutes, but it still doesn't give us, and I think that'll give us kind of a different way of looking at this, but it's still not going to give us a lot of specific answers as to why these specific places are mentioned. I don't know that that's a knowable thing. What's more interesting about this list of places in Numbers 33 is that is how many of them there are. And there are two different numbers that are potentially symbolic sorts of numbers, and it depends on how you count. If you count the extremes, you have your starting spot before you begin the journey and your ending spot where they are now. And so if you count those plus every stop along the way, there are 42 stops in Numbers 33. If you don't count them because that's where they began and that's where they ended and the stops are the ones that you're counting, there's 40. So you either have 40 or 42. And again, both of those are potentially symbolic. Certainly the fact that they had 40 places that they stopped after 40 years in the wilderness, there's kind of a nice matching up of ideas there. Why are these places listed? Well, there's 40 of them, that's why, and they've been in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, there's not a direct equating. It's not literally one stop per year. You know, that's not how it lines up exactly, but it could have that kind of idea of these 40 places between Ramses, where they began, and the plains of Moab, where they are now. But if you count inclusively and begin, talking. If you count inclusively and include that first and last stop and you have the 42, what's interesting about that is it gives you six sets of seven locations. And so if you think about it in terms of what they have been through up to this point and getting to the border of the promised land, they have completed six periods of wandering in the wilderness. And so they are about to move into the seventh period of time since they left Egypt. And the seventh period is, you know, quite literally the Sabbath period. And what are they doing? They're going into the promised land where God has promised to give them rest. And so that's a possibility in terms of what's going on, you know, why this number of places. And of course, there's always a possibility when you have that sort of thing that it doesn't mean any of those things and we're just making things up. So, but it is, you know, it's kind of striking that either way of looking at those numbers gives you something to think about at least a little bit in terms of these places. Now, actually, let me stop for a second. Like I said, we're gonna come back and look at this same list of places again from a different perspective here. But before I get into that, questions or comments about anything we've said so far, Brian?
So speaking of making things up here, when I was reading chapter 33, I got the impression that there's a parenthetical thought here that all this listing of they moved and they moved, the points being made that this is not the way it was supposed to be. You know, they're being punished. And it's a reminder to the readers of that, that perhaps that's a point. Am I making that up?
I would say perhaps to some degree there's some of that there. I mean, obviously some of this was part of the journey. You know, beginning and going to Mount Sinai and all the way up to Kadesh Barnea, which isn't mentioned specifically here, but some of this is part of the plan, but a whole lot of it isn't. And so, in particular, if you think of that, you know, 40 places to remind you of the 40 years, and there are some things, as we'll talk about here in a minute, that some of the places on the itinerary are memories that wouldn't be too good of memories for the people. And so certainly there are these echoes of their past failures in all of this. And there may be something to that, that there's a reminder that the list shouldn't be this long as they reflect on it. Yeah, there's something certainly to be said about, you know, looking at where you've come from as you consider where you're going. And this is the sort of thing, something I was reading about this chapter was interesting. It was kind of an anecdotal sort of thing. It was someone telling a story of the way he used to vacation, which was their dad gave the kids notebooks, and they tracked all sorts of bizarre details of their trip. You know, the time they were from one stop to the next, where they stopped, what they got, how much, you know, gas they put in the car, what time of day it was, you know, what they saw here and there. And it was the drive time, not like a diary of the vacation. It was all sorts of trivial details about the trips. And he said he didn't know why his dad did it. My guess was to keep the kids busy. But whatever the case was, he says, you know, now when he and his siblings go back and look at those itineraries of the travel, all of this just blah, bizarre, weird sort of data, he said that he and his siblings have all of these incredible memories about these trips, just from these little things. And so what he was saying is, you know, we read a chapter like this and we're like, ugh, this is terrible to trudge through this. But if you are with this generation, every one of these place names is probably going to call to mind all sorts of things. In particular, if you're thinking about this in terms of God's faithfulness to them through the journey, it would have a very profound meaning for them to sit and think about where they had been in the past. So that's kind of an interesting take on this, is just how different it would have sounded to them versus how it sounds to us. David?
It's not really dissimilar from telling a story with a genealogy.
Yeah. Yep.
If you know the names, then it tells the story.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? All right, well, another way of thinking about this list, I got to stop looking at that screen, that typo is going to drive me crazy, is to think about it in terms of the type of places and events that occurred in them. So, for example, some of these places in the list emphasize the Lord's faithfulness to them in some moment or another. So, for example, in verses 3 and 4, they set out from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after Passover, the people of Israel went out triumphantly in the sight of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them. On their gods also the Lord executed judgment. That is great victory for the people of Israel, and deliverance from bondage and what they had endured there. Down in verse 8. And they set out before Hahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness. And they went a 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Etham and camped at Marah. And so what happens? They pass through the midst of the sea. And you're reminded of the parting of the Red Sea and the deliverance of the Israelites there. In verse 9, they set out from Marah and came to Elim. At Elim, there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there. And so they have been through the wilderness. They've been through a stop where things didn't necessarily go so well with the water. And then God leads them to this oasis in the desert. And then after a long list of places without a lot of detail, we get down to verse 40. And this is one of those that without the backstory, it doesn't mean a whole lot. But if you were there, or if you remember back to chapter 21, and the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who had lived in the Negev in the land of Canaan, heard of the people of the coming of the people of Israel. And that's all that says. Back in chapter 21, what we're told is he heard of them coming and he marched out to war against them, and he promptly was defeated, and God had given the Israelites their first victory over a Canaanite king. And so you've got a half dozen or so of these spots along this list that very clearly emphasize God's faithfulness to them. And again, to this conquest generation, who they will be eventually, the value of remembering and revisiting and reflecting on God's faithfulness is really important. And that's one of those things, too, that I would say is a very practical thing to reflect on, because it's probably no less important for us than it was for them to build our own faith for the trials that lie ahead, is to recall where we have come from and who has brought us safely thus far. And so reflecting on God's faithfulness is an important part of preparing for the journey ahead. But there are also a variety of places that emphasize the people's failure. So Marah is talked about in verse 9. That's where they complain about no water. Then they find water and it's bitter water, and they complain about the bitter water. Verse 11 makes reference to the wilderness of Sin, where they have no food and manna is given to them. Verse 14 talks about Rephidim, where again they complain about not having any water. Verse 16 talks about Kibroth HaTa'avah, which is where they complain about the manna that God has given them, and they want the food of Egypt instead. And in verse 36, they are in the wilderness of Tzin, which is Meribah specifically, and this is where Moses strikes the rock. So you've got a lot of stories that aren't very good wilderness stories. But what's really interesting, there's a reason I didn't stop and read all those verses the way I did in the first group. The reason I didn't read those verses is because all it does is have those names. It doesn't tell the stories of their failure, but you know the stories of their failure. I mean, you go back and read Exodus 15 or Exodus 16 or Exodus 17 or Numbers 11 or Numbers 20, and those tell the stories. But they're not recounted here. And that is a really interesting thing to reflect on. One is it gives a context for God's faithfulness. God's faithfulness is not in the context of their sinless perfection. God's faithfulness is in the context of God being faithful to what He said in spite of their sin. His trustworthiness to His promise, and His intent to keep what He has said He is going to do. But the fact that no details are given in any of these places regarding their failures reminds us not just of God's faithfulness, but of God's forgiveness. That God is willing for this people who have, you know, that first generation is gone anyway, and the second generation is doing very well at this point. God is willing to not hold this sin against them forever. Another way of saying it, if you want to flip the idea, is the first one emphasizes the Lord's faithfulness, and the second one emphasizes the Lord's forgetfulness, or the Lord's forgiveness. And it's a reminder of what you see in so many other places, like Psalm 103, that blesses the Lord who forgives all iniquity. As far as the east is from the west, so far does He remove our transgressions from us. Or Isaiah 55, this passage that talks about God's ways and thoughts being so much greater than ours, is not just in the context of God in general, but specifically in the context of God's forgiveness. Or 2 Corinthians 5, if anyone is in Christ, he's a new creation. The old has passed away. The new has come. And what matters in all of these texts, and what matters here as well, seems to be not the past failures, but the forgiven standing before God where they are right now. That God does not continue to hold that against them. And so God's faithfulness is set in the context of their failure, but it's not a failure that lingers on. It's a failure that's forgotten because they're forgiven. And that is a really important thing to think about as well. Okay, Vaughn? Right. Well, and that entire scene there is such selective memory. We remember the fish that we ate that cost us nothing. You know, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and all those things. I mean, I'm sorry. It was free, technically speaking. It was because you were a slave and your master had to feed you or you were going to starve to death because you weren't going to be buying your own food. And so the idea that life was so much better in Egypt is so obviously a false reconstruction. Their motivation, isn't really spelled out that much. The rabble is named as being a part of what instigates this, and this seems to be a reference to that mixed multitude outside the camp, most likely. But why everyone just goes along with it? I mean, you've got that kind of mob mentality. I saw a study on this at one point, and it was a terrifying thing to read. And it was talking about the number of people who will do things they would never do on their own once a certain threshold. You know, a certain number of people start doing this, they'll jump right in and do it too, even though they would never do that on their own. It was just terrifying to think that that's the case. And yet every time there's riots, you see it. People who would never behave in a certain way go out there and do these things. And so it may be that kind of mob mentality is part of it. Obviously, I think the text is suggesting that they were tired of that diet for whatever reason. Obviously, they were not a thankful people at all. The one thing that is universally true of that Exodus generation is they couldn't see past the nose on their face. Whatever was right in front of them, whether it was good or bad, was the only thing they could see. And the moment that thing changed, their entire perspective changed. And so the notion of, you know, we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen, is completely foreign to them. All they looked at was what they could see. So they complain when there's chains. They celebrate when Moses comes with miracles. They complain when the Pharaoh makes them get more straw. They, you know, it's complain, celebrate. All they could ever work with was what was right there. And so that's probably part of it as well, as just how superficial this generation was. David?
You know, they're not mentioning it. There's also a level of which, you know, if I say Shiloh and Tietam, Age of Normandy, I don't need to say anything more. We know exactly what that location means. And so you can say the name of the location. Everyone knows why that place has been mentioned and what it means.
Yeah. And that is absolutely true, but I do think there's still a contrast between this first group that does tell the stories, usually, not always, but it does tell the stories, even though I think the same thing would be true of those. And so the stories are told where things are better, and they're not always told when things are bad, and I think that still is reflecting something of an emphasis in this chapter, perhaps. And then there's the third group, which is a whole bunch of places where, as far as we know, nothing important happened. Their names, we don't know anything about them. Some of them we know where they are. Some of them we don't even have any idea where they are now. They've been so lost to time, we can't even really conjecture where they were. There's no detail in Exodus or Numbers about anything that happened in these places, and there's no detail in this list about anything that happened in these places. And it's a reminder to just kind of reflect on this idea that life as a whole is more than just a collection of highs and lows. It includes a whole lot of other stuff that happens in between, and what I'd say is probably most of our lives aren't our spiritual highs or our spiritual lows. Most of our lives is kind of, you know, not dramatic moments of deliverance, and it's not horrific moments of moral failure. It's apparently insignificant days where we do ordinary routine stuff. And what about those days? Well, I think the message of this chapter is that God is guiding them and protecting them in those days too. Whether they see it or not, whether the sea parts in front of them, that doesn't mean God wasn't guiding them on those days. And you see that in you know, retrospect, you get to the end of the wilderness and their clothes haven't worn out, their shoes haven't worn out. That's not something you think about every day. Oh, look, my shoes haven't worn out today. Oh, look, my shoes haven't worn out today. It's just one of those day-by-day things you don't even notice. But in retrospect, you say, you know what, all of those non-entity days, God was there too. And the question that we ask ourselves in retrospect is, was I with God? I know he was with me, but, you know, where was I in the midst of all of that? And so, we have opportunities to be faithful. We have opportunities to be faithless, even if it's not in momentous ways. In the first two categories are the big things, but we are still either faithful or faithless on those apparently insignificant days where we're doing ordinary routine stuff. So, that's what I have to say about that part of the chapter. Thoughts or questions, comments about any of this before we move on to something different? All right, well, from here to the end, it begins to start talking about things that have to do with entering into the promised land. And the first thing that's going to be talked about is driving out the Canaanites here in verses 50 through 56. So the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you pass over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their metal images and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and settle in it, for I have given you the land to possess it. You shall inherit the land by lot according to your clans. To a large tribe you shall give a large inheritance, and to a small tribe you shall give a small inheritance. Wherever the lot falls for anyone, that shall be his. According to the tribes of your fathers, you shall inherit. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then those of them whom you let remain shall be as barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall cause you trouble, or they shall trouble you in the land where you dwell, and I will do to you as I thought to do to them." So, here is a message from God to Moses to give to the people that obviously envisions the land as a land that has been cleared of all foreigners and all foreign gods. Which, as you know very well in the verses that I have on the screen as well, point out, did not ever happen. In fact, some of the language that's used, let's look at a couple of these verses over in Joshua and Judges. The language that's used is kind of striking, maybe a little surprising to find when you think about it, because, I mean, this was God's plan, this was God's command, and so you would think that, well, what you'd think is that what is said wouldn't be said. So notice in verse Joshua chapter 15 and verse 63, "The Jebusites, the inheritance of Jerusalem, the people of Judah could not drive out." So the Jebusites dwell with the people of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. They could not drive them out. Chapter 16 and verse 10, "However, they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites have lived in the midst of Ephraim to this day, but have been made to do forced labor." Chapter 17 and verses 12 and 13, Yet the people of Manasseh could not take possession of those cities, but the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in their land. Now when the people of Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not utterly drive them out. So you've got two that say they could not drive them out, and two that say they did not drive them out, and two that say they put them to forced labor instead of driving them out. And specifically, this last one says, when they grew strong, the implication was they probably could have done it now, they still didn't do it. And so what you have in Joshua are a whole bunch of phrases that really should not have belonged in the vocabulary of these people when it came to this topic. They could not do it. They did not do it. They subjugated them instead of dispossessing them. And so in Judges 3, they live among the Canaanites. They intermarry with the women and they serve their gods. You know, the last time we had a story of living among the people and intermarrying with their women and serving their gods, that was Baal Peor, is what that was. And so Numbers 25 is basically being reenacted by the time you're getting to the book of Judges. And so, obviously, the people are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. You know, Joshua and Judges sound more like Baal Peor than Numbers 33. You've got a problem. And so, why don't they do this? Well, again, we don't have all of the details of every single battle in terms of what's going on. But I do think the implication is not that God did not empower them to do it, but they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. And we're not told every motive and every reason, but the bottom line is what they are told to do here in Numbers 33, they don't do. What God envisions as the ideal for what this land is supposed to be, it's not. Because the people don't drive out the enemies. And like it says here, they are a barb in their eyes and a thorn in their side. And in the end, he does to the people of his own people the same thing that he intended to do to the Canaanites. The difference is he's successful in doing it where his people failed in driving out the Canaanites. God drives his people out when the time comes. And so this is a high ambition, great plan that the people fail to follow through on. And that gets us also to this next point, which is the boundaries of the land, which are described in the first half of this chapter. And this is another spot we're not going to read through all the details here, but it's given by the southern boundary in verses 1 through 5, the western boundary in verse 6, the northern boundary in 7 through 9, and the eastern boundary in verses 10 through 15. This is another spot where some of these precise locations are unknown, so it's hard to be very precise. I've seen a few different maps that try to draw this out. Here's one that works relatively well. There are two different, if you can see the two different colors and the key on the top, the top one says it's the extent of the promised land according to Numbers 34. The second one says the land occupied by Reuben, Gad, Manasseh there on the east side of the Jordan. So that's what those colors represent if you couldn't read that from where you were. I've seen some versions of this. The top right city is Zadad. I've seen some where it comes a little bit more due south before crossing back over to the Sea of Galilee. But by and large, this is a pretty accurate, as far as we can reconstruct it, version of the boundaries laid out here in Numbers chapter 34. And what is significant about this, and the reason I said I wanted to talk about this in correlation with them not driving out the inhabitants, is because this is another thing that doesn't happen. There is no point in Israelite history where their borders looked like this. Even during the time of David and Solomon, when it was at its largest, it did not extend that far north. The standard way of talking about the land from Dan to Beersheba, Beersheba is here, and Dan is about the same level as Tyre up at the top, and look how much further north this border goes. And so they don't really have a lot of the east side beyond those 2.5 tribes. And so it's one of those things that this is an idealized promise, just like the command was an idealized command. And not only did they not have that far to the north, I don't know that there were a whole lot of times, even during the times of David and Solomon, where they completely drove out the Philistines and they had the Mediterranean coastline there. And so this is what God wants the people to have and to do, and the people don't do what they're told to do, and so they never have completely what he told them they were going to have. Now, this does match pretty well, let me take a step back, outside the Bible in Egyptian literature that we've excavated and have access to. Canaan is talked about as a geopolitical entity, and the borders in those 14th century BC Egyptian documents basically match up very well with this. And so the biblical descriptions of Canaan and the ancient Egyptian descriptions of Canaan line up very well as far as we can reconstruct those things. So that's a nice little mark for biblical accuracy. But the people just don't do what they're supposed to do at all. All right. Like I said, I don't have a whole lot to say about that first part of chapter 34, but I'll stop again. Now that we have God's command to eradicate the Canaanites and this boundary as it's drawn out, and ask if there are questions or comments about anything at this point. Boundaries are just so exciting, aren't they? Colleen? And that's one of those things, and we've talked about this before, that there are conditional promises, there are unconditional promises, and how do you know which one's which? Well, it's really easy when the condition is stated, and it's a little bit harder when it's not. The fact that God promises something and then it doesn't necessarily happen exactly the way that he said is not a failing of his, especially when it has to do with, go drive the people out of the land, and they're like, they can live here, it'll be fine. That's not God's fault that they made that choice. And like you said, the same thing is true in our lives. God makes great promises to us, and sometimes we sit around and say, well, God, why didn't you do this thing? Well, maybe it's because of you that God didn't do this thing. An example of that I give, I like your example of peace in our lives, and any number of reasons why that doesn't happen based on what we're doing. An example that I give is this, with every temptation, there's a way of escape. God, why didn't you give me a way of escape in this temptation? Well, he did. It was 30 minutes ago that you ran past 5 ways of escape with blinders on, not looking, and you got yourself to a point where you were, completely stuck. And it was your fault, not his, that you weren't paying attention to the multiple ways out that he's given you. I compare it, I don't know if this is a good comparison or not, but I like it. I compare it to those, B-rate horror movies where there's, a killer in the house, and everyone knows there's a killer in the house, and there's this girl standing on the front step thinking really hard about going into the house, and you're watching it going, you idiot. If you go into that house, you're going to die. You wonder how many times, if our life was a movie, and sin is in the house, we're standing on the doorstep thinking really hard about going in, and anybody watching is saying, it doesn't take a genius. It really doesn't take a genius to know if you walk in that house, and there we go, merrily walking right in, and, why didn't you give me a way of escape, God? Yeah, it was don't walk in the house. That was the way of escape. There's probably any number of good examples of that we could think about. Tom?
Kadesh Barnea is where they were camped when they sent the spies into the land, and then they go all the way to Lebo Hamath at the north. So that green area really represents the area that the spies have, spied out.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there's a kind of a connection in terms of, again, what the land should have been for them, and of course, it wasn't because they didn't go in to begin with.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's one of those things I read and meant to write down. So I'm glad you said it. The northern and southern borders here basically equate to the journey of the spies back in Numbers chapter 13. And so this is the land they spied out, and they don't go into the land, and now this is still the land as God describes it here, and then of course they don't go take it as they ought to. Anything else here before we look at the last part? Yes. Where were the Hittites? Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. The Hittites, they were a migrant people, apparently. They came down from Europe, Asia Minor is what it was called in biblical times. So Turkey area, as they moved down. Where specifically they are, I mean, you have all that list, the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and the Termites and, you know, everything else. But I don't know off the top of my head where each one was specifically located. I don't know if anybody know that?
Well, I think, you know, the Hittites had a great empire.
And yeah. Most of that. And they were kind of encroaching from the north.
This is kind of frontier territory for them, and they intersected with the Egyptians. So they're kind of stuck between those two.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so that's right. The Hittites were a very, very powerful people and kind of moving in from the northern side. And we know the Jebusites were in Jerusalem, but like the Hivites and the Perizzites and all those, I don't know that anybody has any, you know, pinpoint knowledge on that. So,
who held Damascus?
Well, the Lord holds it in his hand with everything else.
All right.
You know, at this point, I don't know. The Arameans, were they around yet? You know, the Arameans, the Syrians, that was, you know, but I don't know the history of all those people off the top of my head.
By the way, some people draw the boundaries to include Damascus.
Yes.
Part of that, which is interesting.
Yeah, and so, like I said, some will bring that boundary further south before cutting back over to Galilee. And that is, we read that last time, that you know, Galilee to the Dead Sea along the Jordan is the hard east side boundary in chapter 34. But yes, some of them draw it down a little bit further, and Damascus is part of it. I've seen some that it's like all the way down near Ramoth-Gilead before it cuts back up. So, again, it's hard to be precise on some of this, but yeah. Yeah.
One final thing is, I guess the closest Israel gets to this being its area is they do subjugate these local areas that pay tribute to them, like the Arameans, the Edomites, and so on. So you could say, you know,
in some sense,
but it wasn't like
right
the actual territory.
Yeah, it was more along the lines of, you know, those Joshua passages where they subjugated the people and made them do forced labor, except it was they subjugated them and made them pay tribute. They did not drive them out of the land and possess all of this land at any point. So yeah, that's an important point, and it's also an important distinction to make there too. All right, before we run out of time, verses 16 through 29 are lists of tribal chiefs who are going to be, well, verse 17, these are the names of the men who shall divide the land to you for an inheritance. And so Eliezer and Joshua, first of all, and then one chief from every tribe to divide the land for an inheritance. Go ahead, Kayvon, hit that one time. Thanks. And so, you know, I'm not going to read through all these names, but it's a person per tribe. And what I would stop and reflect on here for just a moment is that this is the third list of this kind that shows up in the book of Numbers. We have the 12 census supervisors back in Numbers chapter 1, where they are organizing the people for this march from Sinai to the Promised Land. And the inauguration of that march, the beginning of this march to the Promised Land from Mount Sinai, you've got the list, and here we go. And then in Numbers chapter 13 and 14, we have the spies, that first group of spies that go to spy out the land. Of course, we'll have other spies later on. But that first group of spies that go spy out the land, and you've got that list of 12, and you have with that the decisive rebellion of the Exodus generation that seals their doom, that they are going to die in the wilderness. And now here in Numbers chapter 34, it is these tribal chiefs who are going to be dividing up the promised land. And what you have here is, again, these plans for this future allocation of the promised land to the conquest generation. And so you have these three lists of people, 12 people from tribes, and each one of them marks a significant turning point in the book. Right at the outset, where they're beginning their march to the promised land, and the next one shows up when their fate is sealed and the people are going to die and they're leaving the promised land to go wander in the wilderness. And now here at the end of that time period, where they're about to go in again, and this is how you're going to divide up the land, is by these people. And so they're, you know, obviously they're names of people who are going to do real things or who did real things. But on top of that, it almost serves as something of a structural marker within the book of Numbers, that when a list of 12 names of people from tribes shows up, something important is about to happen, and you've got kind of a change. You've been encamped at Mount Sinai for a while, now it's time to go. You're at the border of the Promised Land, now it's time to go wander in the wilderness. And you're at the plains of Moab, now it's time to get ready to go in and start thinking about the land being divided up. And so, again, it's just a list of names. It's nothing too terribly exciting, but it does have those sorts of echoes of these earlier lists, and serves a similar kind of purpose, if not the same purpose. So that's just about all the time we have, a little bit past time, actually, depending on how you want to count. What I mean is, by the clock, we're past time. By 5 minutes since the bell rang, we're not. So we do have, we have a little bit of time if anyone wants to make any comments about this or anything else that we've talked about today. Kayvon said no, so rang the bell. All right, well, we will call it a day for today, and we've got two more chapters to go in Numbers, but that'll be 2 weeks out. We'll have a singing next week.